The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week I talked about equanimity and only scratched the surface of the topic. And I would like to today continue on this theme of equanimity. And today I'd like to talk about social equanimity. Last week I talked about using meditation practice as a laboratory for discovering how to be equanimous, how to be non-reactive, how to be even-minded, how to be keep the awareness open. Equanimity is a state where awareness stays open and balanced without being hijacked by our thoughts, our reactions, our feelings. Awareness doesn't get contracted. Sometimes it's all too easy for awareness to get lost in our thoughts, our concerns, our preoccupations. We're always aware, but we're not aware that we're aware. And awareness gets lost, gets kind of... And there's something very significant about when mindfulness is strong, when awareness is strong, there's almost as if, I don't want to say exactly the same as, but it's almost the same as you know that you're aware. You're aware and you know that you're aware. If someone asks you, are you aware? You say, oh yeah, I'm aware. That sense of presence is very strong. And that sense of awareness is stronger than anything that's going on around you or in you. Not to deny anything or push anything away, but the awareness is like almost like this larger power, this larger reality, this larger presence, this larger event, that that because it's larger than anything that's within it, it doesn't get pushed around by the various things that go on in our life, the events of our lives, and concerns, worries. Equanimity is considered to be one of the most sublime and beautiful states in Buddhism. It's kind of considered to be kind of the crown jewel of practice. And but because partly because of that, it's also one of the most difficult ones to understand, for one thing, but also to experience, to develop. When we talk about equanimity, there's plenty of times that people protest. People worry about equanimity. Is that indifference? Is it, you know, maybe it's not okay to be equanimous. You're supposed to be interested, involved, and worry about things properly. So today I wanted to talk about social equanimity, meaning the equanimity we have in our relationships to other people. And the equanimity we have in the relationship other people have towards us. And the primary place in the Buddhist tradition where this kind of social equanimity is discussed is as one of the Brahma Viharas, one of the sublime abodes. And these are four states of mind, or four emotional states, or four attitudes that are closely linked to love, Buddhist idea of love. There has to do with the primary social emotions that Buddhists cultivate or develop or celebrate. And the first is loving kindness. The second is compassion. The third is sympathetic joy. And the fourth is equanimity. And the first three, that loving kindness has to do with a simple wish that someone else be happy. It's a beautiful thing to cultivate, to have it close by, so that it's a ready, almost like a habit, that you, when you encounter someone, when you think of someone, that your instinct, your impulse is, it would be really good if this person can be happy or safe or healthy. Wouldn't that be nice? And it's a kind of happy love. It's a kind of a happy producing kind of goodwill that we have for others. It's said that this goodwill of loving kindness is the foundation for these other three, for compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. It morphs into the others, depending on the circumstances. So if you encounter someone who is suffering, that goodwill morphs into compassion, where the wish is, may they be free of their suffering. May their suffering come to an end. And that's a beautiful wish that human beings have, that when we encounter someone else, there's almost our empathy connects to their suffering. We almost feel it sometimes kind of like our own. There's kind of a closeness to it, a close connection to how we take it in. But rather than being a victim to that suffering, rather than being oppressed by it or troubled by it, there's this beautiful instinct or feeling or attitude of compassion, wanting that person to be alleviated from that suffering, and perhaps in that wish, doing something about it. The third is when the goodwill encounters someone who's having a good time, they're happy, they're having success, then that goodwill transforms itself into what's called empathic or sympathetic joy, appreciative joy, where you're happy at their happiness or their success. And that also comes along, that attitude comes with a kind of a wish. And that wish is, may their happiness continue. So the first three of these, the four most social emotions, come with kind of, the attitude comes with kind of a wishing, kind of a hoping, or kind of an intention that, that something continue or be a certain way. So the first is, may people be happy. Second is, may they be free of their suffering. And the third, may they be, may their happiness continue. The fourth was equanimity. Now, it's very important to hear that this is also kind of a love, a kind of very positive emotional state that is also a morphing, a transforming of this goodwill. And but it's a kind of goodwill that we can have when it doesn't make sense to continue with the first three. So for example, we might wish that someone not suffer, but they continue to suffer. And there's many reasons for that. And even if we go in and try to help them all we can, sometimes our help doesn't make a difference, and they continue to suffer. Sometimes it's because of choices they make. And you could see, you know, that they're just kind of digging themselves their own grave, and the choices they make, making very stupid choices, but they seem to not be able to not make them. And you've tried to help them, you've stepped in many times, but they keep making those choices. A very common area in families where this many family people struggle is around addictive behavior within the family. Someone's alcoholic or a drug addict or some other addictive behavior, and they've been helped many times, intervened many times, try to be helpful, but it just seems to be not helping. Give the person money. That didn't work. You know, give them a place to stay. That didn't work. You know, they bring the problems home with you, to them, to you. There's many, many problems. And so eventually, you know, the person's kind of, you find themselves kind of losing your job, losing all kinds of, you know, ending up in the streets. I've talked to parents who, children, adult children, ended up living on the streets because of the alcoholism. And they tried everything they could to try to intervene and help and make a difference. But they just couldn't, you know, finally said we had to kind of just wash our hands of our son because it just wasn't, nothing else was working. So there are times when, you know, terrible things happen to people and our wish that they be free of their suffering is a beautiful wish, but it's not a wish that's going to make a difference. There are times when people have success or happiness and your wish is may that happiness continue and they make foolish choices. And those choices obliterate their happiness, their well-being. And then we might wish them happiness, loving kindness. And things happen in life. They make choices in their life that as much as you wish them to be happy, it doesn't happen. You know, they make choices that take them the other direction. So you still care for them, but it doesn't make sense to continue wishing something which is not going to happen. So then the fourth form of goodwill is equanimity. And equanimity here means doesn't mean we stop caring, But it means that we stop feeling responsible for them. We stop getting caught up in the drive or the need for something to be different. I think of this kind of equanimity as a kind of beautiful kind of acceptance of a situation that maybe shouldn't, you know, you would say maybe shouldn't be accepted. But it isn't the situation that's being accepted or the actions that are being accepted, but it's the person. I like to distinguish between actions and people. And people make their own choices. And we might feel those choices are the wrong ones, or they might, events might happen in a way that maybe they're, you know, it's unfortunate. But it's possible to meet people and have our awareness open, non-contracted, available, present, to meet them with respect, with a sense of care, but not being pulled into their world and entangled, or codependent, as called sometimes now, entangled in that world, to stay equanimous and balanced, but also a sense of seeing that you're there. Repeatedly in my Buddhist practice life, I've encountered people who have seen me that way, and it's been very meaningful for me to feel their acceptance or their equanimous acceptance of me at times where I thought I was in big trouble. I thought, you know, normally I thought people were going to really judge me, be angry with me, reject me, whatever. There were times the things I did, maybe in the scale of things, they weren't that bad, but I thought for sure I was going to be kicked out of the monastery. And lo and behold, I was just met. Sometimes nothing was said. And it was recognized what happened, but nothing was said. And that, in that acceptance, equanimity, it was, I certainly could take stock of what I've done, but it was very meaningful that I wasn't being personally rejected for the things I've done. Or the story of when I've told maybe too many times of when I was 14, taking my father's car for a joyride and crashing it into a bulldozer. And so then having to call up my father at work and say, your car? I thought I was going to be in big trouble. in terms of he was going to be angry with me. But what he did was he said, well, what happened to the car? And he says, does it still drive? And I said, yes, but we can't open the right-hand door. And he said, okay, why don't you see what you can do about it, and I'll look at it when I come home. And that was it. And now, maybe you think a 14-year-old should have more serious consequence than that. Grounded, maybe getting a good yell. I don't know what. But I think that was such a powerful lesson for me. He knew that I felt terrible. He knew that it was clear, I think, that I got the point. I got the lesson. I didn't need any more lessons. And there was this equanimity, this acceptance. Let's take care of the situation. And that was a very powerful lesson for me about taking responsibility, but also about a certain kind of acceptance or certain kind of something. Or when I was in the monastery in Thailand, the first monastery I was in, I was following a schedule that the abbot had given me. And one day I didn't follow the schedule, but went for a little walk around the monastery kind of casually at the time I was supposed to be meditating. And lo and behold, who's walking around the monastery also but the abbot? And my usual operating mode is to feel guilty. Back then, if you're guilty, if in doubt, be guilty. And so it was the worst possible scenario to be caught, not doing the schedule. And And I remember this beautiful thing. He was maybe 50 feet away or something, and we were kind of walking perpendicular to each other. And he turned and looked at me. It was far enough away, it was like not like he was going to greet me or anything. But he clearly looked at me, saw that I was there. And it was this kind of open awareness. It was almost like I was a tree there. It was like non-reactive. Just he saw me. It didn't agitate him at all. Didn't concern him at all. And I felt that it was this kind of I felt this acceptance that was more than just acceptance. It wasn't active. It was just I was just there, and it was very healing for me because of this tendency to feel guilty, feel bad, to judge myself, to be the kind of the first thing, the first instinct that I would have, to just be seen without any judgments, without any reactivity, without any, just seeing. I felt like I was seen really deeply by him in some deep way. So, how do we, what is that attitude that we can have towards situations which are not going well, situations in the world around us with other people, where it's appropriate and significant to have the kind of to have equanimity, to have this accepting awareness, open awareness, balanced awareness, even-minded awareness, whatever you want to call it. Now, one of the reflections that is given for this kind of equanimity is not a wish. Remember, the first three forms of goodwill come with a wish. May you be happy, may you be free of suffering, may your happiness continue. The fourth is not a wish, because it only makes sense to have equanimity when wishing is not going to help. For all my wishes, so the fourth reflection is not having may something happen, but rather is this. And this is a very, very strong statement that's meant to be reflected and considered, debated with, struggled with, wondered about, studied. So the statement goes like this. Beings are the owners of their actions. The heir to their actions. The word for actions is karma, and actions doesn't quite capture the full meaning of the word karma. Another way of saying it, beings are the owners of their intended actions, their intentional actions. Beings are the heirs of their intentional actions. So another way some people like to say this in America is they say, I care for you, but the choices you make are your own. And so we see that people make all kinds of choices, maybe for themselves, that are not our choices, not the choices that make sense to us, or it doesn't even seem smart. And so how do we grant people or leave people alone in their capacity to make their own choices? Or how do we not take responsibility for the choices they make? In a number of religions, it's considered very significant to grant people, almost as a sacred right or sacred dimension of life, to grant people their own free choice, to allow people to choose for themselves. And in Buddhism, that's also there, that I don't know if granting is exactly the right word, but there's a deep understanding that people make their own choices. And some people make choices which are not so wise. And sometimes the choices people make play out years and years into the future. People start living a life that seems to work when they're in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but it's a life when they turn to be 70 doesn't work out anymore. And so the choices they made early in life are choices that led in a direction that wasn't good after 40, 50 years for them, and then they end up kind of destitute or struggling or something. So what is it about that reflection that beings are the owners of their own intentional actions? Beings are the owners of the, are the heirs of their intentional actions. That helps with equanimity. that helps us not get entangled in it. So what do you think of that? So I'd like to hear from you. What is it about that phrase that is helpful? So if you could pass it over to Charlotte. Do you have a statement or a question, Charlotte? Because this is the time for, not for questions, but rather I'd like to hear from you guys why you think that statement is helpful.
No, I'm just going to tell you why it isn't helpful.
Yeah, I kind of wondered. So so I think let's come back to you near the end then.
You were okay with that, right?
let's wait to the end. Because I think it's very valid, probably valid what you have to say, and important to talk about maybe why it's not helpful. But I think we'd start laying the ground by talking about how it's helpful. So do you have another mic that can go?
I think it helps me because it's a reminder of what I can do with my wishes versus the other person, what the other person is doing.
So say a little bit more. So,
because I may wish that they be happy, that their happiness continue, and that may not go anywhere, despite all my best wishing. Uh-huh. And when my wishes don't go anywhere, then it's kind of, I have to accept that they're going to do their own thing, in a way.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
I think if people are responsible for their own choices and we give them that and we don't try and interfere with that, if we can't help anymore, how best for a person to develop and find their own way towards enlightenment?
So then they have to take responsibility for themselves more clearly.
And for their own enlightenment.
Yeah. Some people don't take responsibility for themselves until they're given that. Left alone. So I say, over here. Lisa, can you? Yeah.
I think it's helpful because if the wishes haven't done any good, if you don't accept their actions for what they are, you just end up torturing yourself. So it's a continuation of suffering, but now the suffering is your suffering. Uh-huh. And this is a way to help alleviate that suffering. Uh-huh.
And what are some of the triggers for you to suffer when someone else is?
Well, you know, you said that there's empathetic joy, it becomes empathetic pain. you know, and all the things you mentioned before, guilt. You know, what have I done to contribute, or what have I not done? Uh-huh. And it may not be the life that you choose for yourself, but this person has chosen it for them, and at some level, they have to recognize the pain that they're causing other people, because you've tried everything, and it hasn't helped so far.
Mm-hmm. So maybe they're only going to learn when they reach rock bottom. They're only going to learn when they experience the consequences. Behind you.
I have two people with whom that's helpful. I second what the lady just said. That applies to my relationship with my 19-year-old son. I've used up my three wishes, and equanimity is about that's what's left. The other is that I have known a person who lived that way in his professional life. And that person is a very great inspiration to me in this area.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Couldn't you also look at it as sort of a commentary on the limitations of your ability to understand whether an action in the long run is positive or negative? In the sense that crashing your car into the bulldozer when you were 14 probably in the long run is actually a really great lesson and a good thing.
Yeah.
And as I've gotten older, I've found that I'm wrong a fantastic number of times. But seriously, about whether or not something is good or bad. I mean, I just have real doubts about my ability to understand, to know that when I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're wrong a lot, or if you don't know it when you see it, then they own it and they live with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really in no position to meaningfully evaluate it or to pass judgment on it, because you're just going to be wrong.
I think what you're saying is very wise. I think that making mistakes, experiencing suffering, are all part of life. We can't avoid it. And to not understand that everyone has to have their share of difficulties, struggles, mistakes, is going to prevent equanimity to be there. But if we understand that to some degree this is part of life, and everyone has to contend with these kinds of mistakes, struggles, whatever, and that it's possible to learn, and there's a path through it to freedom, to liberation, to maturity, to a wiser life.
Maybe that mistake or that suffering is the only way to that state. Yeah.
So, for example, I find it very hard to be a parent. It's sometimes hard to be equanimous, because parents have to choose to some degree for their kids. But here's a story of my son had a teacher who had a problem with anger. So should we have taken him out of the class, out of the school? What should our role be? Should we go in there and insist the school fire the teacher? Should we, what should we do? You know, it's not good to have teachers yelling at their kids in anger in class when they're really teeny. And on the other hand, another consideration was, if we protect him too much from life, he's not going to learn how to work with people. He's already a little bit protected environment already. And so it's kind of protected school in many ways. So maybe it's important to be around people who are angry periodically growing up to learn how to contend and work with it. And our role as parents is not to protect them from the anger, but to certain way be equanimous about it, but to show him and teach him other skills of how to be with it. So the equanimity that allows people to struggle, to go through life and have difficulties, and that's part of important part of any life, is to go through that. I think what you're pointing to, is that right? So behind you there.
Is it okay yet to ask a question? My question is, you presented equanimity as the thing you do after you give up on the other three. And I'm wondering if they can all be done at the same time.
Yes.
Because I honestly believe I try towards equanimity, yet I feel that sometimes I also have to be involved either the empathetic joy or the other side of it, all the compassion, the trying to fix and correct at the same time, yet I'm still trying to be equanimous. And there's a little tension between those desires. I'd like your comments on that.
Yeah, I don't know about tension between them, but I think there are times when the situation is so clearly requires different approaches, different attitudes, that they're quite different from each other. But I think that with, for example, loving kindness, you could wish, or compassion, it can be infused with equanimity. I mean, you can, if equanimity is non-reactivity, the wish can be there, but the need for the wish to be fulfilled is not there. There's no need, there's no demand, no sense of responsibility tied into it. It's kind of very open and free and clean that way. I think that as practice develops and grows, one of the things that grows is a greater and greater sense of equanimity, of balance, a capacity not to be pushed around and caught by all kinds of things. And so then our emotions, our feelings, our relationships are mixed with this equanimity much more and more, this balance or this openness or this clean, unreactive kind of approach. Some people are worried that's indifference, but I think it actually allows for the other emotions to work more cleanly through it. It's like a clean channel. So here.
Good morning. Are we still in the session where we're reacting, where we're commenting on the statement?
Please, yes.
And to my non-native speaking ears, I'd like to clarify if I heard the statements correctly. So it says, beings are the owners of their actions, heirs to their actions or karma, heirs as in H-E-I-R?
Yes.
Okay, so I heard it correctly.
I'm not a native speaker originally either, so I can't. I'm in trouble with some words, and heir is one of those. I just can't say it right. So I apologize.
No. I thought it was my ears, not your mouth.
No, it's one of those things. Some people make fun of me. I've learned to be equanimous about it.
So the first statement I understand, but it's the second part of the statement that I like to respond to. Beings are heirs to their actions or karma. And that particular part of saying resonates with me because I was born outside of this country, and for the first 8 years, I was raised in a very different environment. And I remember as a child, the adults around me highly emphasized as they were raising me that I be kind towards those who are around me and towards even animals and plants. So being kind was a quality that they expected nurtured and cultured within me. And the way they explained to me was that in this world there are a lot of sufferings. And I didn't understand sufferings as a child, but I believe them. And it was through my kind actions, kind thoughts, kind behaviors, kind reactions to things that I could alleviate some of their sufferings, and more than that, not to cause more suffering towards others. And it was also through kind behavior and kind reactions and thoughts that I produce kindness and goodness in others who were receiving this kindness or kind thoughts from me. So I grew up very, I guess, in a way, good. And then my family came to this country, and I spent my years, teenage years and college years in this country. And then I realized in being in a very competitive world that being kind, you know, the way I was brought up and was raised for many years, ain't going to cut it in this country. So for the past 6 years, I came to IMC, and then there's this lesson on being kind and being compassionate. And it's almost as if I am now being brought back to the childhood years of the way, in the way I was taught to think and behave. So I just want to say that particular part of the saying that you have just told us brought me back to those years and resonated with me.
So we say that, so one of the meanings of the owners of our karma, or heirs to our karma, is that the choices we make sets in motion a variety of chains of cause and effect that can play itself out in the short term and the long term. So if you act kindly, that sends in motion something very different in the world than if you act meanly. And some of those things can come back and right away, and some of them might come back in 20, 30 years. And so perhaps you set a foundation in your youth for kindness. And so that's still there. It resonates. It's still maybe a habit or an instinct or an understanding that you have that's quite deep. And so, and because of that seed was planted, perhaps now later in life it's sprouting in the wasteland of... Yes.
I wanted to comment that as a paid professional, professional helper.
Yeah.
Had I known what about equanimity earlier on in my life, I think I would have avoided a lot of self-inflation, a lot of self-deflation, and a lot of burnout.
Thank you. So here in the front.
From the fourth of the five remembrances, we could use the language, I am the beneficiary of my deeds.
Also, yes.
It's easier to pronounce.
Thank you for your compassion. So now, Charlotte, do you want to...
Yes. You know what my issue is.
It's on.
It's not... My issues sort of shift as we were talking about this. So you have a situation... I think equanimity, when you look at... There's great injustice in the world. There's things like child trafficking. There's a lot of suffering of children, say. So you can't use that phrase in those situations. I think you still have to use equanimity.
Right.
But you're sort of looking at the world and saying the whole world is heir to its deeds. But
right.
You can't look at the individual in certain situations, or I can't,
right.
And say you are heir to your karma.
Uh-huh. Well, I tend to agree with you. There is a tendency in some areas in Buddhism to be very kind of absolutistic about this karma thing. So, you know, if someone is born into a horrible situation or a young child is taken into, trafficking, say, well, that's their karma. And because of what they did in their past lives and all that. And I just it doesn't compute for me. It actually... But what it seems to do to some of the Buddhists who have that, it's not dismissing it. I think in Western ears, at least, it's often karma is often looked at as they're responsible. And in fact, the way it functions, I've been told or seen in some of the Buddhist countries in Asia, is the saying that's your karma. This happens is not that you're taking responsibility, but allows for a certain kind of. Equanimity, maybe it's not the right word here, but a certain kind of people still care and they try to get involved and do something to change the situation. But it's more like, I don't know how to say it exactly, but it's more like this is the way things are. And as much as we're maybe horrified by some things, there's not this extra contraction that around it, or tightness, or resistance, or kind of saying this shouldn't be there. But it's there because of causes and conditions. Now let's see what we can do about it. Traditionally, the Buddhist teachings on karma has not been a teaching to excuse things or explain things away. It's been, the emphasis has always been the teaching on karma. Given how things are now, how do we now respond better? How do we make it better, the situation? And so I hope that we don't use this kind of teaching as a way of ignoring injustice in the world. But we use the teaching of equanimity so that we don't lose our cool when we're fighting injustice. So we can stay even and balanced. And, yeah, Steve. What?
Hey, Gil, I think you should talk about, with the four Brahma Viharas, they all have near and far enemies, and one of the near enemies of equanimity is indifference.
Right.
So one has to be really... sensitive to that, but also look at it as you as an individual, you see some injustice and you can go, well, it's their karma. But if you look at people's motivations behind that, there's either greed, aversion to the whole situation, they don't want to act on it, and you're creating karma for yourself. You're giving an opportunity to either be compassionate, take compassionate action, or loving kindness, or some skillful action. So you always have that choice on your end, too. So it's not like being indifferent to the world.
And I think that, remember, equanimity is the fourth of these four, right? So it really builds or is founded on the other three. So, you know, when you see injustice, hopefully some of the earlier ones kick in first. You know, compassion, care. And when the compassion doesn't work, where we can't, doesn't, you know, then perhaps we use equanimity to protect ourselves, protect the compassion from being, you know, causing undue suffering and distress for us. So finally, it's time to stop, but I wanted to also point in another direction, two other things. One is this statement that beings are, what is that, how's it going now? Beings are the owners of their actions, the beneficiaries of their actions. You know, it helps, that's supposed to help bring equanimity. But you could also direct it towards yourself. You are the owners of your own karma. You are the beneficiary or the heir. So no, you'd always benefit from your karma. That's the problem with you. It's always, you know, that. And so how is it that saying the statement to yourself reminds you to have a certain equanimity of the consequences that you have to live through? You make choices that have consequences. And then how do you stay patient with those consequences? How do you stay equanimous, realizing I have to accept this, and I have to live with this now, and I'll be, you know, present and open, and I won't defend myself, I won't hide from it, I won't run away, I won't get angry and lash out at someone. This consequence is a consequence that I have to now just be with, because this is the result of actions and choices I've made. So that's a whole topic in itself, but I think it's a very important one for the social equanimity to have happen. And then finally, what I tried to do here today, by having you guys talk and all that, is to emphasize, I wanted to make the point that this is an investigation, exploration into this topic, that we, it's not so like a done deal, like now I understand how it is, but rather to explore, you know, how is it that we can be equanimous? What is equanimity in this situation? How do we understand responsibility? How do we understand who lives the consequences in our relationship to it? And as we investigate and explore these kinds of things, that investigation exploration shifts the center of gravity of where our preoccupation is, out of preoccupation, out of reactivity, into those mental functionings that support equanimity, that support open awareness, that support a freer awareness. The very capacity to question, to explore, to investigate, try to understand better is one of those things that helps make that shift from being lost in our reactivity, preoccupations, to stepping out of it and finding a wise way of being with this world of ours. And hopefully to live in the middle of our world with a degree of freedom. So I hope this gives you something to explore. And if it doesn't, then I'll be equanimous.